What if everything we've been taught about morality is merely a comfortable lie? Friedrich Nietzsche's Beyond Good and Evil confronts us with this unsettling possibility. Published in 1886, this provocative masterpiece doesn't merely question our moral assumptions, it dynamites them. Nietzsche invites us to venture beyond conventional wisdom into dangerous intellectual territory where genuine wisdom might be found. Like a philosophical detective, he uncovers the hidden psychology behind our most cherished values, challenging us to question whether truth itself might be nothing more than a useful fiction. Philosophers have worshipped the will to truth without questioning its value. What if deception and selfishness might actually have higher value for life than honesty and selflessness? Behind all logic lie physiological demands for maintaining a specific mode of life. Our conviction that certainty is worth more than uncertainty, truth more than illusion, these might be merely necessities for beings like ourselves, not measures of reality. To recognize untruth as a condition of life places us beyond conventional morality. Philosophers aren't the disinterested seekers they claim to be. They're advocates defending prejudiced positions with after-the-fact arguments. Every great philosophy has been its originator's confession, an involuntary autobiography. Their metaphysical assertions reveal their deepest moral impulses. The Stoics claim to live according to nature. What magnificent self-deception! Nature is boundlessly extravagant, indifferent, without purpose or justice. Living itself means valuing, preferring, being limited. Philosophy always creates the world in its own image. It is the most spiritual will to power, the will to create rather than discover truth. Knowledge requires sailing beyond conventional morality, crushing our moral prejudices to access deeper insights. This intellectual journey demands courage, but promises unprecedented revelations to those brave enough to venture forward. We remarkably simplify our existence. Our senses access only the superficial, while we maintain a willful ignorance that grants us freedom. Knowledge isn't ignorance's opposite, but its refinement. Independence belongs to the strong few. Those who attempt it unnecessarily prove themselves dangerously daring. They enter a labyrinth of multiplied dangers where no one witnesses their struggles or understands their conscience. Should they falter, none will sympathize, and retreat becomes impossible. Our profoundest insights appear as follies or crimes to unprepared ears. What nourishes higher humans may poison others. A philosopher's virtues might be vices in common men. Throughout prehistory, actions were judged by consequences rather than intentions. In our moral period of the last 10 millennia, we've inverted this perspective. Now we may be entering an ultra-moral period where we recognize that an action's decisive value lies in what is not intentional. The religious soul reveals itself as a vast psychological hunting domain. To understand the problem of faith requires both Pascal's profound experience and a wicked spirituality that can oversee this dangerous territory. Early Christian faith differs from the sincere slave faith of northern barbarians like Luther. It resembles Pascal's continuous suicide of reason, a sacrifice of all freedom, pride, and self-confidence of spirit. This faith subjects the spirit to something indescribably painful, forcing it to accept the absurdicism of God on the cross. The religious neurosis connects with three dangerous prescriptions: solitude, fasting, and sexual abstinence. This neurosis often manifests as extreme sensuality suddenly transforming into penitential world renunciation. Psychology has failed here by believing in moral oppositions rather than interpreting them as textual phenomena. The passion for God appears in various forms: the churlish importunity of Luther's Protestantism, the Oriental exaltation of undeservedly elevated slaves like Augustine, the feminine tenderness yearning for unio mystica et physica, the mightiest bow before saints, not from piety, but because they divine in them a superior force of will. They honor in the saint something within themselves, their own strength and love of power. Every moral system functions as a tyranny against nature and reason. Yet this constraint-like, metrical restrictions that strengthen language may be precisely what develops everything valuable in human thought and conduct. This tyranny, this arbitrary law, may be what is most natural. Artists know their most natural condition requires strict obedience to thousands of precise laws that defy intellectual formulation. The essential element appears to be long obedience in the same direction, ultimately producing what makes life worth living: virtue, art, music, reason, and spirituality. Throughout history, the many have obeyed the few, creating an innate need for obedience, a formal conscience commanding, "Thou shalt." This instinct accepts commands from all authorities, explaining mankind's limited development. When morality serves only gregarious utility, morality of love to one's neighbor cannot exist. Sympathy initially exists outside moral valuation, entering moral perspectives only after society secures itself against external dangers. Those who see democratic movement as a degenerating form of political organization must place hopes in new philosophers strong enough to initiate opposite values, forerunners who would teach humanity its future depends on human will. The danger lies in these philosophers possibly lacking or deteriorating. Every elevation of the human type has been the work of aristocratic societies that believe in gradations of rank. The pathos of distance emerges from class differences and the practice of commanding and obeying, enabling the self-surmounting of man. Higher civilizations originated when barbarian conquerors, men of prey with unbroken will and desire for power, overwhelmed weaker, more peaceful races. Two primary moral types recur throughout history: master morality and slave morality. In master morality, good equals noble, while bad means despicable. The noble type determines values independently, honors strength, hardness, and self-mastery. Slave morality, arising from the oppressed, views existence pessimistically. It values qualities that alleviate suffering: sympathy, kindness, patience, humility. Here, evil describes the powerful and frightening, while good means safe and harmless. Life itself is essentially appropriation, injury, conquest, and exploitation. Any living organization must embody the will to power, growing and acquiring ascendancy not from morality, but because life is precisely will to power. The European consciousness resists this truth, dreaming of societies without exploitation. But exploitation is not a corruption. It is a primary organic function of all living beings. Nietzsche challenges us to examine our deepest assumptions with unflinching honesty. Are our moral systems merely expressions of our own psychology rather than universal truths? Is our worship of truth itself a prejudice? Could our democratic values be signs of cultural decline rather than progress? These questions remain as provocative today as when Nietzsche first posed them. His vision of the free spirit who dares to venture beyond conventional morality offers both liberation and danger. By questioning what seems most certain, we might discover new possibilities for human greatness, or lose ourselves in the attempt. The true legacy of Beyond Good and Evil isn't a set of answers, but the courage to question everything, even our most cherished values. In a world increasingly defined by moral certainties and tribal allegiances, Nietzsche's willingness to stand alone in dangerous intellectual territory offers a model of authentic philosophical courage that remains unmatched.